All right, the first case this morning is Singh v. Cordell, and it's case 17-3230 and consolidated with 17-3244. I think they're separately being argued. Yes, thank you.
I didn't understand the last thing you said about the...
I think you're going to argue them, or you're arguing for both parties, both cases?
Both cases.
All right, good enough. Separate, consolidated for argument as well. Thank you.
And may it please the court, David Cooper, for the defendants in this case. I would ask if there's time remaining, I would like to reserve up to 2 minutes for a rebuttal, but I don't have any expectation of having time, having experienced this members of this panel before.
Such a cynic. Go ahead. Let's see.
I'm here today, Your Honors, to ask that this court grant Dr. Cordell, David Cordell, qualified immunity, and then to affirm the dismissal of the remaining claims by the district court. And I'll begin first with the qualified immunity appeal and move on to my arguments on the cross appeal. The First Amendment claim against Dr. Cordell should be reversed because Dr. Singh's speech was not protected speech both under Garcetti and under the Connick versus Myers test. Dr. Singh's speech, his binder submitted to Dr. Cordell in support of his attempt to retain his appointment and to ask for promotion and tenure, was speech pursuant to his official duties under Garcetti.
What official duty? He has a duty to try to continue to work there?
Under the broad view that this court addresses and the fact that it was within the chain of command, it was within the scope of his duties to seek to continue his employment. Short answer, yes.
I've never seen that in a job description. A duty to, you have a duty to continue to seek employment even when we don't want you to. That just strikes me as bizarre.
In the cases, this court's cases say it doesn't have to be in the job description in order to be within the scope of one's
official duties. It doesn't have to be in the written job description. It's got to be understood in some way. And if that's pursuant to his job duties, I can't imagine what wouldn't be. Can you give me an example of something that's not pursuant to job duties?
Well, it would be the matters that were addressed with respect to the Brammer versus Holter cases, where the members of the faculty were addressing issues outside the school with citizens and parents, as opposed to inside their chain of command and addressing claims for tenure and the like, they were addressing broader issues that this court held were both not pursuant to their official duties and of a public concern. Which is the second arrow to this bow, which is the Connick versus Myers test, which is Singh's binder also was of a very personal nature, limited in scope, and not of a public concern. He was not attempting to divulge to anyone outside the university or to anyone in authority his claims of discrimination. Rather, he was saying, I shouldn't be non-renewed, I shouldn't be fired, I should instead be retained and promoted because. And under the Connick versus Myers test, the content, the form, and the context show that to be internal in scope, personal in nature. And in fact, it's very much in line with the facts of Connick versus Myers, because Myers in that case was... the speech at issue in Connick versus Myers was a questionnaire by the employee saying, this transfer of me is a bad idea and I don't want it to happen. And so the seminal case with respect to whether it is or isn't of a public concern, Supreme Court says something like that, saying, I want to keep my job, please don't reassign me or fire me, is inherently not of a public concern.
What if Dr. Singh would have aired all these grievances and things that were in his binder? He just put them out there in a blog or something. And during the process of deciding whether his contract was going to be renewed, the administration read it and said, you know what, this just supports everything we thought before, so we're going to go ahead and terminate him.
Well,
that would be different, wouldn't it?
That changes the context and the forum in which Dr. Singh would be speaking, and it would be a different case.
Right. But you agree that would, I mean, that far more on the actionable scale, right?
It becomes closer, and it removes, it at least moves it to the right of being questionable. And with respect, and again on the qualified immunity, if the conclusion is that it is protected speech, whether it's not pursuant to his official duties and is of a public concern, the question is that clearly established under the whether the precedent of this circuit of the Supreme Court? And the answer to that is no. Again, we go to Connick versus Myers.
Well, how about my hypothetical, though? On my hypothetical, it would be clearly established, wouldn't it?
It would be closer because, you're speaking outside the agency and both the Brammer and the Knopf cases as well would say something that where you go outside the chain of command, there's a line of cases in this circuit that talk about even if you go outside the chain of command, that's not dispositive as to whether it is or not.
Right, but I mean, in my hypothetical, he's complaining about racism and discrimination in a public forum, right, on a blog.
Oh, okay, then I missed it. I thought you were talking about if it's just exactly the same thing.
It's the same information, but he just instead of providing it in a binder to the administration, he put it out on a blog.
I would concur that it is much closer to being clearly established.
Okay.
Yes. And I just mentioned the Knopf case, and that's one of the other thrust with respect to the qualified immunity issues that we're addressing on these appeals, is because in terms of it being clearly established, we need to determine that it's clearly established such that somebody in the position of Dr. Cordell, a non-lawyer, non-judge, would be able to know beyond a debate that this is protected conduct. And the Knopf case was very much the poster child, I think, for the argument, because that one case drew three different opinions as to whether it was pursuant to official duties, whether it was close to the line on being official duties, and Judge Matheson for the majority that it was pursuant to official duties, and that's what makes it not protected or warranted judgment for the defendant. Judge Briscoe in concurring saying it's a close question, but it's certainly not clearly established, so qualified immunity is appropriate. And then she went on to say that it's not also of a personal nature, not speaking as a citizen, and therefore wouldn't be protected speech anyway. And then, of course, there was Judge Ebel in the dissent, which went the other way entirely. So if a panel of three judges of this court can't agree on what is speech within one's official duties, and whether it is or isn't of a public concern.
Getting away from speech for a moment, and getting back to the point you started with Judge Hartz, the public concern, personal concern. I can see a United States senator or congressman, a president, running for office and saying that whether they get to keep their job or not is a matter of public concern. And I suppose that could be true, say, of a city councilman or a mayor. Is it true for a professor in a private university? Is it true for the administrative staff of a university? Are there any distinctions to be made on the personal public concern aspect of Garcetti along those lines?
Well, it would be the Connick-Pickering analysis as to whether it's a public concern as opposed to being under one's official duties.
Well, protected speech under Garcetti.
So under the Garcetti-Pickering test, the short answer is no, it's not. And that is, again, the Myers case to a T, which is don't do this to me. It's an employment decision I don't like, and please don't do this to me. And the Supreme Court said
that's not protected. So the issue of retaining his job, that is getting back to the initial question that we started with, this is a matter of personal concern.
Agreed. And then, and so it's not protected speech.
That's, I think, where you threw at least me off, and I understood Judge Hart's off as well, because you sounded like you started off conceding practically that it's a matter of public concern.
No. I don't agree with that. And that
well, what do you mean agree? That's what we understood you to say.
Okay. I did not intend to convey that.
All right. Thank you.
Okay. Filed on Monday and then with the clerk yesterday the supplemental authority addressing the requirement that we have a case sufficiently.
By the way, on that, was that new authority that you submitted in your supplemental authority?
Escondido. It was decided January 7th of this year.
Thank you. We're getting these letters citing cases that are 40 years old.
Oh.
I think it's almost a signal saying, hey, this was not included in my initial argument, and now I'm going to try to supplement my briefs by adding supplemental authority.
No, I've read the rule.
It doesn't quite work that way.
It requires that it be new as opposed to something I didn't find before I filed my brief the first time around.
You're right.
With respect to the cross appeal, the cross appeal tends to take cat's paw theory and turn it into something that it's not. Title VII addresses a prohibition of intentional discrimination. And the fact that somebody in the picture holds a bias does not make the decision by the employer a product of that bias, provided, and all of this court's cases, cat's paw theory cases, discuss this, that provided an independent, the decision maker, be free of that discriminatory bias in and of itself, and that the decision maker make an independent determination whether the facts warrant the action taken. And I said this in my brief, but the fact that a biased subordinate says the sun came up in the east does not make this morning's sunrise a product of discrimination. Those just happen to be facts that coincide. By the same token, if A and B dislike each other viciously on the basis of national origin and race, and A sees B drink 6 double scotches in 30 minutes and walk out and waddle out of the bar into behind the wheel of a car, and he calls 911, gives an accurate description of what A saw, and then B gets stopped, and an independent investigation of that DUI occurs, and the DUI arrest happens, A is not the proximate cause of that arrest. That's the same sort of thing going on here.
Who would you identify as the subsequent decision maker on the tenure issue in
Cordell,
this case?
Dr. Cordell. And then his decision was both reviewed by the grievance committee and then affirmed by the university president, Dr. Shadrach.
So but the decision maker, all the way up the chain.
Yeah, the decision maker was Dr. Cordell, and it fits exactly with all of this court's authorities with respect to the cat's paw, which is have an unbiased and admittedly unbiased decision maker take a fresh look, and that fresh look, even though he says Dr. Alexander doesn't like you, the faculty promotion committee says that your teaching service and research are all subpar. I've taken a fresh view. I disagree with them on 2 of the 3 points, but the third point, your service, your collegiality, sorry, that
okay,
warrants
I think
your dismissal.
You said you wanted to reserve some time.
I would like to reserve the balance of my time for
thank
rebuttal.
You.
Don Peterson, and I'm here with Sean McGibber, a partner on behalf of Dr. Singh.
Our basic position on the qualified immunity issue is that there's a fact question that should go to a jury. That's what the district court held.
Let me ask you, On the matter of public interest.
Yes.
We have repeatedly stated that if the employee's primary purpose in conveying information is a personal reason, then it's not protected speech. There's here the primary purpose was obviously to retain his job. It's in a binder that goes to the committee to hear this.
It went to the grievance, or went to the ombudsman, which is outside the chain of command for reviewing his hiring. So it's outside the normal chain
binder,
of command.
The binder was submitted
to an ombudsman.
For what purpose?
For the purpose of getting this more broadly understood. He felt like the normal chain of command wasn't paying attention. He wants to get these issues out there.
When you say the issues out there, how was the school administration to know that his primary purpose was not to keep his job?
For the
and we're talking here under clearly established law. We're looking at it from the perspective of the administrators. And they look at this. How are they to know that this was not his primary purpose?
For precisely the reason that Dr. Cordell found a lack of collegiality, which is that he went through and showed all across the board the more favorable treatment to the white staff and faculty and less favorable treatment to others.
Well, his showing, I don't think you want to rely on that. The showing was pretty thin. What I read when we talked about all these minority people being not staying, the point was nobody stayed. Everybody was getting tired of this system and leaving. Am I factually
correct? I would
disagree
that it's thin, and I'll tell you why. Because there is, in this case,
it sounds like a bad situation, but everybody, whatever their ethnicity, was unhappy, is what it looked like.
The grievance chair's own assessment was that the binder showed racial bias problems in the department. And he told that to Dr. Cordell, and it's admitted that Dr. Cordell responded, "I agree that on its face it shows that. But that doesn't have anything to do with Singh. That's the reason that the speech is outside of this issue." Cordell himself did not see that as speech directly relating to Dr. Singh's complaint about his job.
What relief do you seek from us, then? What relief are you asking from this court?
Well, we'd like a jury trial, and the district court.
A jury trial on what?
On the additional retaliation that occurred because of his speech.
So is this a retaliation case, or is this a case, a tenure obtaining case?
The retaliation
because
has
you said
to do, yes.
The file wasn't submitted for the purposes of tenure. Retention and tenure, that it was submitted to an ombudsman for what purpose? I think you told us it's to make this whole issue public.
Well, to get outside of the chain of command and to make sure there's another set of eyes looking at this department.
You can't get retained and obtain tenure outside the chain of command. It doesn't happen that way.
Right. He wanted another set of eyes to come look at this department, the department which his binder showed had, and the grievance committee's own review, and their secret memo assessment was there's rampant, open discrimination going on in that department.
Well, I apologize because I'm confused about something that I shouldn't be confused about. So he submits this binder to the ombudsman, but it went to a grievance committee. Is that correct? I thought the letter that went to the president saying there's some allegations here of mistreatment and we need to look into it, I thought that was by the chair of the grievance committee, not the ombudsman. Am I wrong about that?
Both. He sent it to both.
The binder went to both?
Is that right, Sean? Yeah, the binder went to both.
Okay, because before you said it went to the ombudsman.
Yeah, and it did.
Okay, So what's the process at the university? Was it to, I thought he did not like the decision of the department chair, and so, or maybe of the president, I can't remember the positions of everyone. And then he sought review, and I thought that review is by the grievance committee. Was it to the grievance committee and copied to the ombudsman, or is the process to go to the ombudsman and the ombudsman decides whether or not it goes to the grievance committee or whatever?
The ombudsman is a completely separate, non-required step.
Let me ask you this question.
It's another channel to let you get information to the university.
Let me ask you about that. So just so we're clear what the ombudsman doing, isn't the ombudsman someone that if you feel like you're not being heard in the process, you go to the ombudsman and they try to put you together with the administration to try to resolve the issue? Isn't that the purpose of the ombudsman?
Yeah, I think that's a fair statement.
Okay. And so, I mean, in this case, I mean, you can say he gave it to the ombudsman, but the purpose of giving the binder to the ombudsman was so the ombudsman would have it to present to the proper people in the chain of command so his voice could be heard.
Sure.
All right.
My crucial point here is that Dr. Cordell himself viewed this to be about things beyond just Singh. And Singh made it that way with the breadth of his binder.
But the issue is, that's not the issue. The issue is whether his primary purpose, if the primary purpose of this binder was to help himself to keep his position at the college, then our precedents say it's not protected speech. So viewing it through the qualified immunity lens, we'd have to say it was clear to the administration that his primary purpose was not to help himself. And that, I think, is a pretty high hurdle for you to overcome.
Yeah, I don't have to. All I have to do is make a jury question out of it. And if they viewed it that way, a reasonable jury could view it that way.
No, that's not. Well, that eliminates qualified immunity, it seems to me.
Only in cases where there's a fact dispute.
There has to be a fact dispute as to whether it's clearly established.
Well, or what his purpose was. I mean, his purpose is a fact question. And if it's clear that reasonable people could disagree about that, that goes to a jury.
No,
and here, Dr. Cordell himself concluded that, you know what, all of this stuff about, you know, Singh is making an issue about the whole department, and maybe we should look into that someday. We might do that. You know, I'm glad he brought it to our attention. That's important. But it doesn't deal with his question.
Well, you raised an interesting point. I would have thought that the test for qualified immunity is on the that it was clearly established law that when the administration gets a binder of this type, the contents of that binder, at least insofar as it claims general racial discrimination, was the primary purpose. And I don't see how, that seems to be a question of law to me, whether it's clearly established that this type of document is protected speech.
Well, and I would suggest to you that if protecting the speech about discrimination and places like public universities matters,
well, it clearly matters. That's
then they need to listen to people who are willing to bring it out when their job's in trouble, because they're not going to talk about it otherwise.
I couldn't agree with you more.
Okay.
But that's not the issue.
Well, it is the issue, because the question is his primary motivation for bringing out all of this stuff about the university. And yes. Dr. Cordell himself retaliated because he brought out that stuff. That's our contention. Okay. The context of it, sure, it came about because he was worried about his job. But to bring out all of this stuff about the department, that's why Dr. Cordell retaliated. He didn't want this coming out. He wanted no one to know about it. That's our theory. And that's First Amendment. That has to do with someone complaining about public activity that is important in a public university.
You have a hurdle to overcome, and that is our precedent saying, even if he does that, even if he talks about discrimination that needs to be dealt with. If his primary purpose is self-interest, it is not protected speech. And what you have to establish here is that it would be clear to any administrator that this was not, that personal interest was not his principal purpose.
What I would say is that I believe Dr. Cordell's own testimony supports that. I want to talk about Cat's paw briefly, if I can.
Well, I want to talk about my question for a second,
yes,
if I may, please, the relief. So you said you want this to go to, you want us to send this to a jury. And what relief are you asking of the jury? What's your case about?
Well,
I thought what happened in this case is that your client did not have his contract renewed and therefore was deprived of remaining on his tenure track, and that is what precipitated this lawsuit, and that the relief you were seeking was what? Blank. Fill in the blanks for me, please.
Well, just you. People work for more than just money.
All right.
And he's a young professor and being put on a suspended leave,
right,
for an extended period of time is damaging to his career.
All right.
And so it's whatever flows from that. I mean, we think that's an appropriate remedy.
So the remedy you want is to have him reinstated to his job, correct?
Probably not. Not
right.
Now.
So if he doesn't get his... Well, has he received other employment in the meantime?
He has. So, yeah.
Well, okay, all right. Thank you.
I was wondering what my source of confusion was about where this binder went. According to the opening brief, and maybe you disagree with this, it says that the Singh also provided a binder of materials to Dr. Cordell. Is that where the binder was delivered? That's different from what you said. You said it went to the ombudsman and also to the grievance committee. Who did he deliver it to?
Fair question. It went to the ombudsman originally, and then it got to everybody? Okay. Yeah.
Okay, and I see your opposing counsel shaking his head, so his opening brief is inaccurate then. Okay.
On the cat's paw issue, this case is distinguishable from other cat's paw cases on the basis of the fact that what Singh was complaining about is inconsistent treatment, inconsistent application of the policy, according to Gwen Alexander, having to do with collegiality. That she treated him and other Asian faculty differently on a collegiality standard than the white faculty, and there's strong testimony about this. Now, if you look, there's a footnote in the Lucero case, the first case from this court after the Staub decision, footnote 6, and it talks about, it distinguishes some cases that somebody tried to rely on, but it points out that if the claim has to do with unequal application of a standard, then the reviewer, in order to be independent, has to get to the bottom of that. And if they didn't go talk to people and get to the bottom of that, you're outside of cat's paw. Okay? So, point number one.
Don't you have a little problem there, though, because the reviewer saying that he was relying on what your client gave him. Didn't Cordell say that he was relying at least in large part on the information provided to him by your client through the ombudsman?
That's what he says, yes.
Okay. So isn't that an issue for you? Doesn't that sort of seal off whatever Alexander was doing?
Well, no. First of all, he also says he considered what Alexander said. And second of all, if the allegation is that she unequally applied it, he has to get to the bottom of that, pursuant to the footnote 6 of the Lucero case.
Where does the grievance committee come in? I thought that was after Cordell decided the issue. It then goes to a grievance committee, which was independent, and they upheld Cordell's decision. Am I wrong about the facts again?
No, they did do that.
So why isn't that an independent ground that cuts off the cat's paw connection?
Well, a couple of things. The point I just made, okay, that if you don't get to the bottom of the allegation that there's unequal application of the policy, then the investigation doesn't really count for purposes of cat's paw. That's right in the footnote. When you're dealing with a claim of unequal application, so what if they confirm the things that she says he did? If other people don't get punished for it, their investigation about just him doesn't get to the point. Okay, so it's not an appropriate investigation at all. And they didn't do anything like that, okay? That's the first point. Second point is, none of this cat's paw thing is almost a sideshow, because we're talking about Gwen Alexander, a dean. She had served as an interim provost, and there is testimony in this case that she personally harbored discriminatory.
Counsel, would you be aware you're 1 minute and 15 yes. seconds over, and then okay. act accordingly.
Thank
please.
You.
Thank you.
There is testimony.
Thank you, counsel. Your time is up. This is my point. Thank you. We understand your argument. Thank you.
A pair of points, and you found the same page in the brief. I wondered, Dr. Singh submitted his materials to Dr. Cordell the same way I submitted my briefs to you through the clerk. It got to the clerk with the intention you would read it. And that was an item of discovery with how did it get to Dr. Cordell.
Well,
Dr. Morales handed it to.
So what's the role of the ombudsman? A delivery boy or to review it also and make recommendations?
It, for purposes of the binder, it was a delivery point, but also to be somebody, a neutral party, to assist Dr. Singh through his grievance procedure. It is undisputed, and Dr. Singh admitted, that 162-page binder was submitted to rebut the conclusion of the promotion committee and Dr. Alexander that his teaching, research, and service all stunk. And in page 1178 of the appendix, which is Dr. Cordell's letter, in the middle of the third paragraph, he talks about, sadly, the materials you submitted to me in support of your reappointment substantiate your service stinks, and you can't, and you're not going to be retained for tenure purposes. Thank you very much, and we're done. It's kind of a red herring to talk about how did it get there. It was there for that purpose.
Okay. Can I ask a question? Yes, even sure. Though time's up, I just want to make sure. Will the record show how the ombudsman office works and how this was handled? So I can be sure I understand
the entire policy manual is part of the record.
Okay, and it incorporates the role of the ombudsman.
Yes,
and the role of the grievance committee.
Yes.
Okay.
Thank you.
That's
you.
Almost two volumes of your record on appeal is the university policy manual.
Thank you, counsel. The case is submitted. Counselor excused.